Well, it's good to be back. I tell you, I apologize for being late. I went up to my hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, where I was born and where what happened was that, you know, no Democrat can win a general election without winning Pennsylvania, for real. And the times that I have run on the ticket, we have won northeastern Pennsylvania by large margins. When I haven't been on the ticket, we haven't done so well. So it's home. And that was the good news. I went home. The bad news is the good news is that everybody showed up. Hundreds and thousands of people showed up. Not 100,000. A lot of people showed up. And it was awful hard when someone, I said, I had to go catch a plane. They said, well, let me tell you, I knew your mother. And this is what I want to tell you. What the hell am I going to say? No, you know, Mom. And by the way, your uncle was a wonderful guy. I went to school with him, man. You know, your cousin. And so it was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. But I think you would have been angry with me if I'd left, because it was all like family. Although I moved away from Scranton when I was a kid, President Trump, who is an incredibly interesting guy, is a little worried about Pennsylvania because it shows me doing awfully well in Pennsylvania. And he went up to Scranton I guess 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, whenever. And he said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing to the press, I don't know this exactly what he said. He said something to the effect that, you know, I know you all think you like Joe Biden, but I want to tell you something. He left you. He left Scranton, if he cared about it. He left it. It's true. I was 11 years old, and I left. I should have told my dad, leave me here, Dad. I'm not going. I'm staying here. I swear to God, he left me. Okay, anyway, but I I shouldn't get going, I don't think. And Vern, thank you, man. Vern, thank you, the former county chair. It's again, I apologize. I apologize for being late. You know, folks, the reason I went home as well is because they've been asking me to come back. And when I say home, even though I haven't lived in Scranton since I was 11 years old, but we had extended family out there. We'd go up on holidays and summers with my grandpa and spend a lot of time. And because it's a town that did so much, like all of you in your hometowns, to shape my life. It's a town like West Point or Fort Madison that shaped your lives. It's a place where Scranton is where my mom and dad, my father, showed my sister and me the values that families are all about. And my mom used to say things like, for real, all the way from the time I can remember, Joey, remember, I mean this sincerely, you're defined by your character. You're redeemed by your loyalty. And she'd always say, Joey, courage is the greatest of all virtues, because without it, you can't love with abandon. It takes courage to trust and to love somebody. Maybe the most important thing they taught me was that everybody, every single person deserves to be treated with dignity. And I mean dignity. No matter what their background, no matter what their station. My dad would never walk by someone, whether they were shining shoes or they owned the institution he was in, without saying hello. Because it's like Iowa. I really mean it. I'm not trying to be nice to you all, but it's like Iowa. I'm being deadly earnest. It's about dignity, treating people with dignity, not looking down on them, not talking down to them. My dad was a real gentleman. He was a high school educated guy. Great regret, he never got to go to college. But I remember he'd always say to me, you're going to be a college man. I said, Dad, what's so important about being a college man? He said, they can never take that away from you. And I'd look at him and I'd say, but Dad, you can still be fired. He said, they can't take it away from you. For him, it was about achieving a level of that just so no one could do anything but treat you with dignity. He used to say that, do you ever remember? To be a man, is what you all think. Joe, you have to be a man of your word. Without your word, you're not a man. For real. Not a joke. I know everybody kids me when I say, give my word as a Biden, but it's sort of a sacred oath in my family, like it is in yours. And you say, I give you my word. I mean it. You know, Air Force, you know what I'm talking about. about, and you really do. You know, with my dad, everything was about honor and family. And again, my dad was a high school educated guy, didn't have any fancy degrees, he didn't have anything fancy about anything about him. But he was just a straight up man of significant character. As I got older, you know, he would always talk about family being, his phrase was, the beginning, middle, and the end. Well, you know, as I got older, I learned more and admired my dad's courage and his resilience. When Scranton fell on hard times, like a lot of folks over the last 25 years in Iowa, when hard times hit, they had to go somewhere else to find a job. My dad was a salesperson. When Cole died and Scranton started going under, if you listen to Barack, he calls me, you know, the scrappy kid from Scranton. We'd think I climbed out of a coal mine with a lunch bucket in my hand or something. I didn't. But my dad made what some of you have seen people have to make, what I call the longest walk up a short flight of stairs to your kid's bedroom to say, honey, I'm sorry, but you can't go to that school anymore. You can't play in that little league field anymore. Daddy, mommy, I lost your job. I got to move. I got to leave. My dad's case, he made that walk. He said, he's going to have to move to Wilmington, Delaware. He said, you know, you're going to move with Grandpa Finnegan. You're moving with him. I'll be home every weekend. It's only 157 miles. I thought that was the end of the earth. But he said, you know, I'll come home every weekend. And when I get things together, we'll bring you, Mom, and your brother and sister down to Wilmington. It'll be okay. And he meant it. But it wasn't until I got older I realized what courage it took to walk in and ask my grandfather, the father of four men, four boys, my mom, and ask for help. It's a hard thing to do, to ask for help. It takes away your pride. But the good news was my grandpa had the same values as my dad. It was all about family. And it wasn't hard for my grandpop to say yes. So we lived with my grandpop for a year because it was family. And everything is about the community. It really is. I know this sounds corny, but it's about how we treat one another. It's about decency. It's about respect. We're lacking it now nationally. We're really lacking it. You know, it's not about, it's about what your values are, where you came from. Scranton is not my home because of the memories it gives me, but because of the values it instilled in me, like the values instilled here, all of you, in your hometown. As I look back, it's where I learned about loyalty, about patriotism. And I mean that literally, patriotism. I remember hearing the stories of the Army vehicle pulling up in front of the house, Staff Sergeant getting out to come up and tell my grandpa, my uncle, my mom's closest brother, was lost in New Guinea, couldn't find him. I remember watching Uncle Jack, who came back from World War II with malaria. They overcame it. But it's about family, it's about faith. You know, and you've all been through some tough times. Everybody's had some tough times. But what gets me through, what I learned, was my faith. You know, the famous philosopher Kierkegaard said, faith sees best in the dark. Everybody has some dark times. A lot of Americans right now are going through some tough times. And when my dad made that walk up those stairs, he told me everything's going to be okay once we get settled down in Delaware. And we all came down, we'll all be together again. Well, you know, it was. My dad made it work. When he said it's going to be okay, he believed it. He believed it because there was still a fighting chance for middle-class Americans. If you worked hard and broke your neck and did all that you had to do, there used to be a basic bargain. If you did your part, You got rewarded. So we moved to a little steel town called Claymont, Delaware. And we rented an apartment, which became Section 8 housing a long time later, but they're now torn down. And then we rented a house. And about 4 years later, we were able to buy a house in a suburban neighborhood, which, you know, like where they turned a farm into 60 homes, or actually 38 homes, and et cetera, as it started to expand out of the city. And it was a split-level home with three bedrooms, four kids, and a grandpa living with us, and or by that time, or a senior, or an elderly aunt with us. And, you know, but from the time we were old enough to listen, when we moved, every time someone would be fall on hard times, whether it was a relative in Delaware, or whether it was because that's where my dad was originally from, or whether or not it was a neighbor or a friend in the neighborhood. Every time they fall on hard times because of recession or temporary loss of a job or a plant shutting down, he'd always say the following, and I give him my word to this. It's, remember, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about how you feel about yourself. It's about being able to look your child in the eye and say, honey, it's going to be okay. And mean it. That's how we were raised, like you, family, loyalty, treating everyone with dignity and respect. I can hear it now, my mother. I don't know whether you remember my mom from the convention, but my mom, she's a 5'1" little Irish lady with a backbone of steel. And she's looking, she said, remember, Joey. I used to stutter when I was a kid. Remember, Joey. Remember, nobody's better than you. And then she'd answer, and everybody's your equal. That's how we were raised. Dad would say the measure of success is not whether you get knocked down. It's how quickly you get up. I said, Joey, get up. Just get up. I have a cartoon from, I think it's a Hallmark store. He went and got it, and he thought I was feeling sorry for myself after the accident and the rest. And it's a cartoon. And so I'm not a big funny paper reader, but there's a cartoon character, Hagar the Horrible, the Viking. And he brought it back, and it's a little frame. I still have it on my desk all these years later. And it's a picture of two frames. And Hagar's Viking craft is smashed into the rocks, and the mast is down, and one of the horns on his helmet is broken. He's looking up at him and saying, why me, God? The next frame is a voice coming from heaven saying, why not? As my dad. Never feel sorry for yourself. Folks, a lot of people across the country, have made that longest walk in one form or another. But today, too many hard work and middle class, working class folks, they can't look at their children in the eye and say, it's going to be better. And believe and mean it. That's why I'm running. I'm running to rebuild the backbone of this country, the middle class. And this time we're going to bring everybody along, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, their gender, whether they have a disability. Everybody's got to come along. Because, folks, Wall Street did not build America. Investment bankers didn't build America. People like you here in Iowa and Scranton and throughout the country built the country. For real. For real. The great middle class built this country. And now they're in trouble. I was asked the other day, I did an interview for 60 Minutes, for 90 Minutes, which is going to be on this week sometime. And the woman, who's a very good interviewer, she looked at me and she said, well, the economy's the lowest unemployment rate, 3-point-something%. How is Trump going to lose? I said, go home to your old neighborhood. See how well all those folks are doing in the old neighborhood with 3.6% unemployment. There used to be a basic bargain in the country. If you contributed to the well-being of the operation you work for, corporation, company, or whatever it was, you got to share in the benefits. Everybody, when everything went up, everybody went up. When management got a raise, labor got a raise. That's not happening anymore. Studies show middle-class families would have difficulty making it if they got a bill. These are there's a half a dozen of these studies the last 2 years. If an average person got a bill they didn't expect in 1 month for $400, they'd have to do one of two things: go borrow the money to pay it or sell something. No breathing room. No breathing room. A lot of folks are losing hope. More than half the people in the country think that their children will never reach the standard of living they have or better. That's never happened before in any of your lifetimes, no matter how young or old you are. Folks, we have to rebuild the middle class. I know I'm always talking about the middle class. I get it. And I'm not just talking about it just because of economic fairness. But I'm talking about because the middle class is what's allowed us to have the political stability and the social stability and the economic stability in this country. When other countries' democracies have gotten in trouble, without a strong middle class, things begin to fray. Things begin to pull apart. But that's never been the case here, no matter how bad it's gotten. We're no longer the wealthiest middle class in the world. And we're losing ground. Let me define what I mean by middle class. Middle class isn't a number. It's a value set. It's about being able to send your kid to a local park or the local school and know they're going to be able to come home safely. It's about being able to send them to a local public school, high school. If they do well enough, you know they can get into, go to be, learn a trade or go on, get a college degree or community college. And somehow you'll figure out how to pay for it. You'll be able to do it. It's about when dad dies, being able to bring home your mom, your elderly mom, and be able to take care of her. It's about hoping your children never have to take care of you, that you'll never be a burden. Where I come from, that's middle class. It's a value set. It's who we are. And it's about being able to maintain in the process your dignity. It's awful hard for Americans these days to maintain their dignity if they don't have health care because they have a child with a pre-existing condition and they can't afford insurance. How does a parent maintain their dignity if that's the case? Or if you have somebody, many of you, how many of you have lost someone to cancer or a terminal disease? Raise your hand. Imagine, how can you maintain your dignity when an insurance company comes along if there's a terminal case like my boy Bo, and they said, you've run out of your coverage. Suffer in peace the last 3 or 4 months. How can you maintain your dignity? It rips the soul out of people. How can you maintain your dignity if you have a child who has an opportunity to go beyond high school? President Obama asked me to do a lot of studies. Remember, he used to love during the States of the Union to say, and Joe's going to do. He'd never tell me what he was going to do. He thought that was really funny, you know? Well, the one he said, Joe's going to do a study on jobs of the future. Well, I did. It took a year. I was able to. The great thing when he gave me those assignments, he gave me presidential authority to task anybody in the administration for help. And you know what? Right today, 6 out of 10 jobs in America, 6 out of 10 today require something more than a high school degree. Today. But what happens when you've got this child, you want to help, and you can't figure out how to help him get into school? You can't pay for it. You can't get the loan. They can't go. How does a parent maintain their dignity? Even in suburban and rural areas, today when they drop off their kids and they're being taught at school how to duck and cover, you have to look here. We're going to build schools so they have abutments in the hallways so if a gunman comes in, you can hide behind it. I spoke to the International Psychiatric Association in London, as well as to the American Psychiatric Association. You know, the people in America have the greatest anxiety of every generation? Children between the age of 7 and 21. Greater anxiety than any other part of this, because they're worried. The single greatest concern nationally, not in every community, nationally, is that something will happen to them in school. It should be the safest place in the world to go. You know, you see it in their eyes. You see it in their eyes when you go to school. You saw it on national television. Kids going in and being told what they had to do, and parents wondering, what do you tell them? My generation, they taught us you had to duck under the desk because there was going to be a nuclear explosion. Okay? Well, that was almost surreal. Turn on the television. Our children are listening. They listen. They see television. The greatest concern of that generation, not in bad neighborhoods, in middle-class neighborhoods, if somebody's going to walk in with a gun that can fire 30, 40, 50 rounds, in some cases 100 rounds. Schools should be the safest place in the world for our kids to be able to go. But yet Trump continues to do the bidding of the NRA and the gun manufacturers. Folks, I believe in the Second Amendment. I've got 2 shotguns, 12-gauge and 20-gauge. I just skeet shoot. My son, Bo, died, and he left 2 of his guns. He used to like goose hunt. You know, if you hunt migratory birds, you're only allowed federally to use 3 shotgun shells as a matter of law. We look out for the geese than we do the public. It's bizarre. Look, how can a parent feel good about raising a child in a neighborhood where the water's polluted, where the pipes are made of wood, or the groundwater supply has been polluted by a company? Look, we all want the same thing. We want a life of dignity, peace of mind if someone gets sick, a little breathing room, a little breathing room when an unexpected bill comes in. Shot at a better future. How many people at their kitchen table this day sat there and asked the question to one another, said, look, you got to drive on those tires another 5,000 miles. We just don't have the money to get a new set of tires right now. Or who's going to tell her she can't go back to school, to college in September? Where are we going to get the money? We don't have it. How many people had those discussions? People we know. Busting their neck. I don't think this president is capable of understanding. He doesn't demonstrate any empathy. He doesn't, I don't think anybody thinks that he thinks about any of these things, about the longest walk a parent has to make, about any of those things. The longest walk his father made was to a bank account to drop off millions of dollars for him. Nothing wrong with that. I wish my dad was able to do that. Let me tell you what I'm thinking about and how we rebuild the middle class is totally within our capacity to do it. One, thinking about health care. 9 years ago, we fought like the devil to pass Obamacare. Many presidents have tried to do some version of it. At that moment, we declared as a nation that health care was more than just a luxury reserved for those who could afford it. It was a right that everybody deserved and central to our dignity and to who we are as a country. It was one of the proudest moments I had standing next to the president when he signed that into law. Generations of Americans have fought to make it possible, and it was a big deal. I think I said something to that effect. Thank God my mom wasn't around. You think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. But it was a big deal. That law has saved lives. I had more people come up to me and say, because I was able to get insurance, kept families from bankruptcy. And we knew it wasn't enough. We fought like the devil to take the biggest step we could move forward with. Now we need to finish the job, to ensure that every single American has a choice to be covered by a public option if that's what they choose. Under my plan, you're free to stick with the insurance you have. If you've negotiated with your employer, given up wages to get it, you can keep it. But if you don't like it, if you don't like it, or if you're uninsured, you can sign up. You can sign up for a Medicare-like option. If you're eligible, for example, for Medicaid, you automatically can be enrolled. If you want to buy in to a gold plan, lower premiums. A plan reduces premiums. No more than $1,000 out-of-pocket deductible you have. It increases subsidies for the middle class. It will significantly reduce the cost of prescription drugs as well. And for the first time, it's going to force private insurers to have to compete not with other businesses, not with each other, but with a public competitor, a public option, if that's what you choose you want to do. You don't have to choose it. Medicare if you want it. But a public competitor. It isn't about to make a profit. That's going to keep premiums lower. The bottom line is my health care plan is the fastest, most effective way to reduce the cost for Americans. It gives everybody an affordable quality insurance plan. The money is there to pay for it. It is less than $30 trillion or $3.4 trillion a month. It's 1/30th that amount, and it can be paid for without raising the tax of anybody in the middle class or working class, period. It cost over 10 years up to $740 billion, a lot of money. But we can eliminate so many of the existing tax cuts that don't generate any progress in America. Not in 5 years. Not in 10 years, and they're good, they're well-meaning. My competitors are really well-meaning people, and they mean it. But you've noticed, none of them told you how Medicare for All is going to be paid for. You've got to come up with $30 trillion in 10 years. $3.4 trillion they estimate per year. That's more than the entire federal budget in a year. Cut everything. And folks, look, Medicare for All requires telling truth to all about how we're going to pay for it. Secondly, we have to rebuild our educational system. Remember you used to have to take the Iowa test, the Iowa exam nationwide? We were the best in the nation. Look what's happened. What's happened? Your state has significantly cut funding like every state has for education. We're finding ourselves in serious trouble for everything from elementary school through college. My wife's a teacher. My deceased wife was a teacher. Jill says it best. Jill's been out here with some of you. He says, a country that out-educates us, any country that out-educates us, is going to out-compete us in the 21st century. Does anybody think, not a joke, does anybody think in the 21st century, in 2020 and beyond, anyone can make it to the middle class and stay there with just 12 years of education? I really don't know anybody thinks that can happen without some inheritance or something going on. So we got to make sure every child has access to good education, regardless of their zip code, whether they live in a rural area or an inner city area. I do that by taking what they call Title I schools, schools that serve the highest number of children in low-income families. And I triple the amount of money we spend on it. Right now, we spend $15 billion a year. We move it to $45 billion a year. Again, within our capacity to do this by cutting some of the ridiculous tax cuts the president put in place. It means every single child in America have access to preschool, 3, 4, and 5 years old. And it's shown. That no matter the child, when they go through that 3, 4, and 5 years old in school, not daycare, they increase by over 50% the possibilities they'll get all through school without trouble, they'll graduate, and they will not get themselves in trouble with drugs or crime in the process. That's what all the studies show at your great universities and others. It means that we'll finally begin to pay teachers what they deserve. Finally. No. Look. Teachers go to 4 years of school, yet they graduate along with social workers with the lowest pay of any four-year, no matter if they graduate Phi Beta Kappa. That's what happens. And guess what? Those of you parents who have children who are in first and second grade, in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to have an incredible teacher shortage. Because now that baby boom generation is retiring. And people are not getting into teaching. It means larger class sizes. It means less opportunity for our children. Because they can't make it. Especially paying their student debt that they had to do to get to college. The work they do is of extreme national importance. Look, folks, these aren't somebody else's children. They're all our children. They are the kite strings that lift our national ambitions aloft. We all in America do better when our children do better. It's more than just my child. And the salary should reflect the duty, obligation, and service that teachers perform. As I said, you know that in the 21st century, 12 years isn't enough any longer. Under my plan, every child will be able to go to school starting at 3 years old, if that's what you decide to do. And they'll be able to go to community college for free and graduate with no debt. And the reason is, and there goes that big spending Democrat, right? It will cost $6 billion a year to do that. You know how we do that? There are $1.64 trillion worth of tax loopholes, not tax cuts, loopholes that exist in the law. Some of them make a lot of sense, like be able to deduct the interest on your home, et cetera. Charitable deductions, a lot of other things make sense. A lot don't make any sense. Eliminate one. It's called stepped-up basis, because I was listed as the poorest man in Congress for 36 years. I didn't know what it was. And as you think I'm joking, I'm not. I released 21 years of my tax returns. It's embarrassing. I have nothing. Anyway. No. Until I wrote a book about my son that became a bestseller, I made more money in that book than I made my entire career. Not a joke. But here's the deal. You know what it does? We can eliminate one thing called stepped-up basis, which costs the government $17 billion a year. It means if you're about to cash in a capital gain from clipping coupons or something, and you, God forbid, get hit by the proverbial truck, and you leave it to your son or daughter, they pay no tax. Not inheritance tax. The tax is owed 10 seconds earlier. Eliminate that one out of $1.64 trillion worth of loopholes. $17 billion of it. You can put every single solitary qualified person in community college, including those who are coming back to be retrained. Look what globalization is doing. Look what Moore's Law, artificial intelligence. Or put it another way, look what is happening with Amazon. There used to be, just 18 months ago, 20 months ago, over 200,000 retail jobs in communities that were, you know, Saks Fifth Avenue outlets or Benetton or Nike or whatever. Well, they're out of business now. 200,000 people lost their jobs. Not because anything has been any bad, because we're shopping online. That's what's happened. They're out of work. What do you do when you're 50 years old? The average age is 49 and a half years old. And you're making 50 a year. And you're either all the family's income or part of it. And all of a sudden you have nothing. And what do? High school educated person at 50 years old. Where do you go? Well, we're making it available for them to go back and be retrained and other things in community colleges for free. And it cuts the cost of a four-year degree in half, if that's what you decide to do. Anybody graduates from community college in this state can go off to a state university, and the first 2 years counts as the first 2 years of the community college. I mean, of the four-year college. So it cuts in half the cost of four-year college. But young people and families are graduating with incredible student debt burden. If you're paying back your student loan and what they call income-based repayment plan, that means that after you pay for everything, your car, your rental, your whatever it is, you then have to pay 10% of that back. What's left? Well, I cut that to 5%. We'll cut your payments down significantly. And if you're making less than $25,000 a year when you graduate with that debt, you don't pay back anything until you make more than 25 and then don't accumulate interest. You make more than that, you pay a small percentage of your income, 5%. But if you commit to public service, national public service, or you're a teacher, a paramedic, you join the Peace Corps, or Teach for America, or counseling victims of domestic violence, or a whole range of other things that fall in the category of public service, you get it all paid off. You get it all paid off. You get $10,000 a year for the first 5 years that you're doing, and after 10 years of doing work, you owe nothing on your student debt. It's only right that our country wipe out student debt altogether, but do it through public service. That's what we're going to do. And thirdly, we're going to have to restore the middle class. We need to start rewarding work, not just wealth. Donald Trump inherited a strong economy from our administration, just like he inherited everything else in his life. And like everything else in his life, he's now squandering that. I don't have to tell all of you here. Look what his trade policy has done. No benefit to anybody. A lot of farmers have gone bankrupt or on the edge of going bankrupt. In my state, 3 years, and mine is an agricultural state, believe it or not. It's poultry, mainly. And they're in real trouble. In addition to that, we're in a situation where manufacturing now is in a net decline. It's in recession across the board. Just go to your local John Deere factories here. But all across America, not just here. We need to build an economy that reflects our values. We've got to start with reversing Trump's tax cuts for the super wealthy and corporations. They didn't need it in the first place. They were doing very, very well. And look what they've done with it. Look what corporations have done. Corporations have taken the profit they made, and they were doing incredibly well. I want corporations to do well. But if you notice, didn't invest in expanding their plants. They didn't invest in their raising salaries. They didn't invest in the community. What they did do, they bought back $1 trillion worth of their own stock. When they buy that stock back, the stock that remains is of increasing value. Fewer people own it, it's worth a lot more. That's how CEOs get paid. You know, when Reagan was president, the average corporate CEO of the Fortune 500 companies made something like 300 and some times as much as the average employee from vice president down to the person on the door. You know what it is today? It's over 400, I think, 56 times as much. What happened? My mom would say, who died and left them boss? What happened? The bargain has been broken. It's been broken. And so, folks, I'm going to change that. The corporate tax shouldn't have gone from 39 to 20%. It should be up back up to 28%, which makes it competitive, makes everybody have to pay their corporate tax. And guess what? Guess what? It raises hundreds of billions of dollars. Why should it, whether you're busting your back on a tractor or in a factory or in a retail operation or in a firm you work for, why is it that you pay if you're, say, a school teacher and a firefighter, or you are running a small farm and your wife works doing something else? Why should you guys pay at a higher tax rate, the tax rate you pay, than people making tens of millions of dollars? But that's how it works. You remember Warren Buffett talking about it? Why should he pay at a lower tax rate than his secretary? Well, it's in fact how it works. So if you make more than $1 million in income based on your work, and you make another $25, $30, $40 million clipping coupons, which is how you do it in terms of your capital gains, well, guess what? I'm going to double your capital gains from 20% to 40%, which everybody in that category should be paying at least 39.5% in taxes. Folks, it doesn't affect capital gains when you sell your property, your farm, or anything else. It doesn't affect that. It affects only if it's all income based on investments. There's no evidence that it's producing additional productivity. Look, we can use this money to restore that basic bargain, rebuild a stronger, more inclusive middle class. Fourthly, we got to stop this god-awful gun violence, as I said. That's ripping us apart. I've already mentioned this, won't go back over it, but why should our children be fearful? Folks, I'm the only one. And at the time I did it, my state was, I think, the fourth largest gun-owning state in the country, little Delaware. We're the sixth largest, smallest state in terms of population. There are five states, believe it or not, smaller. I love it when people start making fun of my state. The Dakotas are smaller. Vermont is smaller, Montana is smaller, okay? But all kidding aside, and they really went after me. But guess what? Even the people who are members of the NRA, they get it. Over 50% of those people think you shouldn't be able to walk around with an assault weapon in your hand. You shouldn't have a magazine that can hold 100 clips. I tell you what, I used to go up and down the streams in my state where the fishermen and hunters are, and the Delmarva Peninsula, a whole lot of areas where there's a lot of duck hunting and also recreational fishing. And they say, Joe, why are you taking my gun away? You're taking my shotgun away. And I'd show them a picture of an AR-15. Or, you think you need one of these to go out and hunt? I said, how many deer are you hunting and wearing Kevlar vests? If you need something with 30 rounds in it, you shouldn't be hunting, man. You're endangering yourself. And they agree. But it's the gun manufacturers. They want to sell more guns. I went out to Silicon Valley and met with people that, you know, you can make sure that you cannot pull the trigger of a weapon unless it has your biometric marker on it. How does that violate anyone's Second Amendment? If you, in fact, say you can only purchase a gun that only you can pull the trigger on, if any of you parked your car out here and left your keys in it, and some 15-year-old kid comes along and takes it, goes out on the highway and gets an accident, you're liable. What happens if you leave your gun case open and the shotgun shell's there? Why shouldn't you be liable? What's the difference? That's how so many people got killed up in Connecticut. Folks, it's just rational thinking. So I've taken them on before, and I've beat them, and I want to tell you, I'm going to beat them again. And the last thing I'm going to say to you, and I'm sorry to say so much, but there's so many things of consequence, and usually when I come out and I don't talk as long when people are standing, but you're sitting, so you're in trouble. Last thing I'll mention, because people say, well, Joe, why didn't you mention A, B, C, or D? The fifth thing that really goes to the issue of whether or not we can live a decent life is to begin to deal with climate change. It's real. It's an existential threat. It's not a joke. I've laid out a plan that's been rated as one of the best plans put forward to deal with climate change. But let me get to the quick of it. We're going to move to net zero emissions by 2050. In the meantime, though, by 2030, the plan — I'm not going to bore you with the detail of it now. You can go online, joebiden.com, and get it. But we're going to lay in down absolutely irrefutable changes that can't be changed in the first 10 years by 2030. We're going to put 500,000 recharging stations around America so that you can — we're going to own the electric vehicle market. We're going to be in a position where we're going to invest $400 billion in new technologies, where we create over 10 million new jobs. We become the nation that is the one that's out there coming up with the new technologies. We have the brightest people in the world we're going to focus on. We'll export these capabilities. And there's so much more I won't go into now. But secondly, the point I want to make is that I was part of that effort in the President and our administration to put together the Paris Climate Accord, to get 173 nations to sign on and say, we've got to deal with this. It's an existential threat to the world. And guess what? This guy walked away from it, losing the respect of all the rest of those countries. He's already lost him in many other ways in terms of his world leadership. You saw the way he abandoned the Kurds and slaughtered. You saw what's happening around the globe. But here's the thing. First thing I'll do as president is rejoin that climate accord. The second thing I'll do, like you did on nuclear proliferation, I'm going to call a meeting in the first 100 days of all the members, and I know most of them because I know virtually every world leader because of the nature of the job I've had for my life in foreign policy and national security for President Obama. And they're going to come to Washington. We're going to up the ante. No one realizes the agreement requires every 2 years to look and see whether we're all doing enough, and the science is becoming more urgent. And we're going to up the ante so we, in fact, find ourselves in a position where, in fact, the world gets back on course to be able to do something. Because if we don't deal with the other 85% of the world, it doesn't matter if we get to zero emissions tomorrow. The glaciers are still going to melt. The seas are still going to rise. The weather patterns are still going to affect us. And so, folks, there's a lot we can do. Climate isn't just an existential threat. But if it's handled right, it presents an extraordinary opportunity. The uniqueness of America is we're the only country in the world faced with crises have looked at it and said we not only can deal with it, we can turn it an opportunity to make significant investments, to generate literally, it's estimated, well over 10 million good-paying jobs, not 15 an hour, $45 an hour jobs. Look, last thing I want to say to you is this. You know, when I got elected as a 29-year-old kid to the United States Senate, I'm really the first United States senator I ever knew. I was too young. When I got elected, you have to be 30 to be a senator. I didn't turn 30 until 17 days after I was elected. And I was characterized nationally and at home as the idealistic young optimist. Well, I got to tell you, I'm more optimistic about America's chances in the 21st century to lead the world in this nation than I've ever been in my life. But the first — for real. We have one gigantic obstacle, the Trump administration. For real. For real. Think about who we are. We have the most productive workers in the world. Workers in America are three times as productive, as a matter of fact, than workers in Asia. We have in the United States of America more great research universities in this state and throughout America owned by the public than all the rest of the world combined. Every single life-changing medical, physical, practical change has taken place in the last 25 years has come out of one of those universities, whether it's Los Alamos in California or the great research universities in this state or on the East Coast. We own them. The public owns them. Business monetizes them, which is a good thing, but we own them. We're in a situation where in the United States of America, we have the largest economy in the history of the world. We're the world's largest economy. And given a shot, we can outcompete anybody, anybody. I've never met a world leader, and I said I've met them all, who wouldn't trade places in a heartbeat with the President of the United States of America. Xi Jinping in China. He didn't have enough water. Not enough water in China. They're talking about $1 trillion project to turn around the rivers so they can provide water for their population. You ever see a picture and know anybody who's ever gone to Beijing or any major city in China is not wearing a mask? They have the highest cancer rate in the world. More people are going to die of cancer by 2030 in China than all the rest of the world combined. That's not a good — I'm not happy for that. It's a reality. We're also somewhere between 30% and 40% of their arable land is polluted with cadmium. It can't produce crops. In the western part of the country, they got 1 million Uyghurs, Muslims, who are Chinese, in prisons. You see what's happening in Hong Kong, what's going on. Come on. I remember having a debate in the late 90s, was Japan going to eat America's lunch? Raise your hand if you think they're a competitor. Come on. This is the United States of America. There's not a damn thing we can't do. I'm so tired of us all walking around, Democrats and Republicans, with our heads down like, woe is me. It's time for us to get up. Remember who we are. This is the United States of America. There's not a single thing we can't do if we do it together. Folks, I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of waiting. We should not postpone any longer what we have to do. So let's do it. Let's take this back and regain America. Thank you. Thank you.